Tonight on Arena, Brian Washington on life in the East End of Houston, Texas, and we visit the Wash for Walls Street Art Festival. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. While rural or rancher Texas may seem familiar to most of us, and thanks to TV's Dallas, we all have a fundamental knowledge of oil drilling. But the urban underbelly of suburban Texas has remained unexplored. Or maybe it was just waiting for the right wordsmith to capture the lives of Black and Latino families who live in the more deprived areas. Brian Washington, in his first collection of short stories, takes the east side of his native Houston, Texas, and offers up a kaleidoscopic view of the many lives that make up that city. In the main, we are in the hands of a young narrator, Nicholas, son of a Black mother and Latino father, working in his parents' restaurant and attempting to navigate the expectations of his elder brother while exploring his own sexuality. The collection was awarded the 2020 Dylan Thomas Prize and was one of Barack Obama's Books of the Year. And Brian Washington joins me now from Houston. That city, Brian, is itself a character in the book. The book is set in the East End. Describe life there, if you would.
Hey there. Well, first I want to say thanks so much for having me on. And I think that one thing that's really characteristic of that neighborhood itself and also Houston at large is just the diversity, and not only racial diversity, but the scope of diversity, whether it's religious diversity, socioeconomic diversity, diversity of various lifestyles, and the way in which folks find ways to come together, even if they're coming from seemingly disparate points. So I think it's just a part of town where you see a lot of folks from elsewhere coming together in one place to make things work.
At the Heights, which is where Nicholas lives, describe the buildings that they live in. Do people live on top of each other?
In a sense, right? Like, a thing about Houston that's gotten a lot of notoriety within the city as well as around the state is that you don't have zoning, which is to say that oftentimes you'll have a number of establishments and a number of businesses that seemingly no correlation with one another, on top of one another, or directly right next to one another. There are a lot of times where you'll hear the sort of running joke that you'll have a Baptist church right next to a preschool, right next to a bail bond shop, right next to a smoke shop, right next to another elementary school, right? And there's obviously detractions to that sort of thing, right? But a boon is that you end up coming to terms with the fact that there are many different ways to live very early on in your tenure in Houston, regardless of whether that's 5 months in or whether that's 5 years in. So you have folks that are day workers that are living next to very old money folks that are living next to transplants in the Heights, as in East End. Much of the city is currently undergoing gentrification, which isn't terribly unique for any major city in the States, but perhaps because of that diversity and because of that lack of zoning, it's a bit protracted and a bit slower and a bit stagnated in parts of Houston.
Nicholas tells the reader that he is too dark for the Blancos and too Latin for the Blacks. Tell us about the role of race and tribes and even skin colour, you know, the very how people really try and either define their differences and similarities by the colour of their skin.
Yeah, I mean, a funny thing about being someone who is writing fiction in the States is, irrespective of whatever you're writing about race, right? If you're not writing about race, you're also writing about race. And if you're writing about race, you're certainly writing about race if you're writing fiction that's set in America. And within Houston itself, you come up with a handful of funny equations in that it would be possible to write monocultural fiction set in the city, but in a lot of ways I feel like it would be intellectually dishonest, and that you'd be neglecting to account for a lot of the various perspectives that are sitting side by side and perhaps like right on top of one another. But it also makes it a place that's really rife to write fiction, right? You just have a lot of opportunity for various perspectives, for various vantage points. And in the case of the recurring narrator throughout Lot, you have someone who is constantly switching codes based on where he's at geographically and also who he's with in any given point in his various revolutions around town. And that could change irrespective of whether or not he's talking to other Black folks, whether he's talking to folks in the Asian American community, whether he's talking to folks in the Latinx community. He's constantly switching through codes as he moves from one focal point of the city to the next. And that's not a terribly different or terribly special way of navigating this particular city, but it was one that I wanted to try and capture on the page.
So Nicholas's family, who are at the core, at least I'd say half of the stories, are representative of that mix that makes up the East End that you describe. Can you describe Nicholas's family for us?
They are a bit of a hodgepodge in a lot of ways, right? I mean, anytime that you're writing about family, it really depends on whose perspective you're writing from, right? In the same way that a mother to one character could be someone who is withholding the freedom of another character, whereas a brother to one character could be a mentor in someone's eyes, and yet in another family member's eyes, it could be a bit of a terror. So the trick with this particular collection was volleying between perspectives to get a sort of kaleidoscopic look at what makes a family. For Nicholas himself, who's the narrator that we're constantly following, his mother is in a lot of ways representative of what he disdains most about the city, while simultaneously being the one person that he looks up to and the one person that he opens up to. And the same can be said in varying degrees to his father, his sister, and his brother. And so the question becomes not what is this particular member of a family to this particular character, but how many different spaces can family occupy in our lives? And if they don't occupy the spaces that we need, then where do we turn?
Yes, because his mother works in the restaurant and really keeps the family, well, as much financially together as she possibly can. But she also puts up with a husband who has a lover across town. So is that what you find frustrating about her?
I don't know that I would say that I'm frustrated by her. I think
Nicholas
that I'm amazed.
Rather.
Yeah. I feel like I'm amazed by her. Like, I'm amazed by anyone who's, you know, putting up with a man at any given point in their life. It's just amazing that they're able to do that. But I feel like for Nicholas, and I think that what he perhaps is frustrated by is also underlined by what he can't see. We as the reader, and you know, it's a planned dramatic irony, I suppose, we're able to see all of the things that his mother is doing in order to keep the family afloat, right? She's making sure that all of the bills are paid. She's making sure that the business is running. She's making sure that she's able to keep each of her family members within arm's length. So while we as the reader see that struggle, and we see all of the things that she's navigating, Nicholas can't see that because to him, she's just his mom, right? And so a lot of playing with the narrative for me was showing the reader various angles and various perspectives that Nicholas or other characters surrounding the other family members might not be privy to. And I think that a lot of ways that forces us as the reader to come to terms and come to our own decisions as to, okay, is this someone that we can fall behind, right? Is this mother that Nicholas can't see for who she is and everything that she's doing? Is she really that bad of a person? Perhaps not. And if she isn't, then what is it about Nicholas where he has these massive blind spots, right? Like what in his experience is forcing him, or rather causing him, just to not see the comprehensive picture of who his family is as a whole.
Yes, because there's a wonderful scene in one of the stories where Nicholas goes on a bus trip with his mom, and that they go to a market, a Latino market, and suddenly she becomes, before his eyes, a different person. Can you describe that?
Yeah, in that particular scene, Nicholas and his mother are taking a trek across town on the bus to a very, very different part of town from the one in which they stay. And it's one of those moments in which Nicholas, even if he isn't entirely explicitly conscious of it, he is implicitly being allowed into a part of his mom's life where she doesn't solely exist as his mother. She's existing as a comprehensive, full person in the way that every character on the page ideally exists as a comprehensive full person. But because Nicholas is simply the son, and he sees what he sees and he knows what he knows, and he has a sort of machismo guiding everything that he's sort of navigating at this point in time, he can't see his mom as a full person. She's just his mom. So while that window is present and he's taking part in it, it simply closes immediately after because he doesn't know what to look for.
Yes, she goes to the market and she does this wonderful dance. And then she warns him not to tell anybody about the dance. So Nicholas is gay, or as earlier on in the stories, I suppose he's coming to terms with his sexuality. He's not quite sure where he might be going. Do you think, as a young gay man growing up in the East End community, it's more harder... You know, it's a harder place to grow up gay than others.
I wonder. I mean, I feel like Houston and the scope of American cities, and I'd preface this with saying that everyone's coming out experience is very individualistic and it's very much their own. So I really can't speak to the experience of what it would be like in mass for folks that are coming out in any given part of Houston. But I do think that Houston as a whole is certainly a lot more accepting than loads of other cities in Texas, and perhaps as accepting as the more accepting cities in the nation. It's a city that really prides itself on allowing folks to live the life that they would like to lead, as long as they aren't infringing on the lifestyles or the sort of revolutions of others. So I do think that whilst there's that general overarching acceptingness within the city and within his particular revolutions throughout the neighborhood, you still have these sort of local politics and these intensely local politics, right? And the question becomes, okay, as Nicholas, I'm a character that is out. What does that mean about my relationship with my mother? What does that mean about my relationship with my father, my sister, my brother, my coworkers, so to speak? And then you constantly have the question of what does it mean to come out for this particular character? Because there's a way in which coming out narratives are often focused on the sort of focal moment of the coming out, and then everything is just amazing after that. While in reality, and what I was hoping to capture on the page, is that coming out is never a one-time event. It's constantly a choice that you're making as you navigate various situations, as you move from one geographic point to the other. You're constantly deciding how much of yourself you would like to reveal and what you would like to withhold and why. So trying to examine how a character like Nicholas would navigate that in a city that is as surface accepting as Houston was something that was a project.
Yeah, but that's very, yes, it's done so well, because he has to navigate it with his brother, which can be pretty fearsome, and then with other, you know, with other friends, then he finds his own group who are more accepting, and many of his friends turn out to be gay as well. Hurricane Harvey in August 2017 had a devastating effect on Texas and Houston and the neighborhood you write about in the story, Eglin. How did it affect people? And then, you know, you talked about gentrification. How did that come about following such a devastation?
Well, it's a funny thing in that there was a confluence of events, I feel like, why Harvey got the sort of global magnification that it received, because he had a number of things happening simultaneously as far as putting Houston on the map, whether that was the Astros winning the baseball championship, whether that was a sort of highlighting that seems to occur every 4 to 5 years of Houston's food scene. And then you have this sort of massive storm that forced so many folks in disparate parts of the city, or seemingly disparate parts of the city, to come together. And the overarching narrative, or I suppose the connecting narrative throughout all of it, was that a lot of folks made sacrifices, not only for themselves and for their families and for the folks in their immediate vicinity, but for folks they didn't know, and strangers and neighbors. And I feel like Harvey really reinforced this sort of togetherness that is implicit and just taken for granted. I feel like if you grow up in the city and you live here in the way in which so many different neighborhoods and so many communities are interconnected. But Harvey was a way of just underlining that it is a very special thing, and it is not necessarily a very common thing. So it was really, I don't want to say that anything positive came out of a storm that just brought so much devastation, that still continues to just like its reverberations in our daily surroundings in the city. But it was calming, at least, to see the ways in which communities were looking out for one another. And gentrification sort of lent in immediately after the storm, because now that you have these neighborhoods that are cleared out, or folks that can't afford to rebuild, or folks that can't afford to rebuild and also pay the upcoming rent, you have folks who do have the money that are coming from elsewhere. And, you know, they're flipping houses into restaurants, or they're flipping old restaurants into new restaurants, or they're flipping entire blocks. So in a lot of ways, the iteration of the city that was portrayed and written in Lott is a bit of a time capsule, because some of those neighborhoods, whether it's the East End, whether it's the Heights, are radically different than they were at the time of writing those pieces, right, like many of those restaurants that are described, like, no longer exist by way of gentrification, by way of just the difficulty of trying to get by in any given American city.
Well, the collection is called Lot, and it's by Brian Washington. It's published by Atlantic Books. Brian Washington, thank you very much. Kenzie is a solo project of 23-year-old multi-instrumentalist, songwriter and producer Kira Lindsay. She's been featured in the past on the Other Voices music trail and has already picked up some champions among our 2FM colleagues, as well as in various online music pages. On Thursday last, Kenzie released her debut single. This is its first play on Arena. See what you think. This is Kenzie with Cold Blue Light.
There's a girl dancing by your side. You grab her wrist and pull her behind. Think you were king cause you were in that show. But darling, that was 7 years ago. Is it some effort to replicate your youth? You're nearly 30 and you can't face up to truth. So you abuse and terrify the young. Well, I hope someone cuts out your tongue.
That's Kenzie and her new single, Cold Blue Light. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. In recent years, Ireland has seen an explosion of street art. First, its political beginnings as murals in Belfast and Derry. Now, street art accommodates all kinds of personal, political and artistic statements. Currently running in Waterford City is the Waterford Wall Street Art Festival, which has transformed once rundown areas of the city and has attracted big names from the world of street art, both nationally and internationally. I'm joined by one of those artists, Vanessa Power, in studio, and the festival organiser, Idel Tobin, is on the line. Idel, can I start with you? The festival is now in its sixth year. How did it begin in Waterford City? What was the impetus to set it up?
Yeah, I guess in 2015, we started Waterford Walls because Waterford had an awful lot of vacant and derelict buildings that were as a result of a very bad economic crash that had never fully recovered from back then. Mm-hmm. And I went to the council in Waterford and asked them would they be open to the idea of allowing artists back in to paint or allowing artists into Waterford City to paint these walls of these buildings. And it kind of grew from there. It actually more than grew, it exploded. It's unbelievable the reaction that it's been getting.
And Idel, where did you get this idea that artists would take on these walls of derelict buildings and you know, create something new out of them?
It's not really a new idea as such. You know, there's many examples of this kind of a project around the world. And art is a great way of rejuvenating public space and in particular areas that are a bit run down in cities. So this isn't a new idea. But what's particularly special, I think, and unique about Waterford Walls is that the council and all the residents and the businesses all have a part to play in making this festival happen. You know, they're all very much involved and it's also a citywide festival. So the art.
And how did you get everybody on board, Idel?
You just literally ask them. Everybody, when you ask and when you tell them what you're trying to do, the first year was obviously the most difficult, but now we're in the privileged position that because of the success of the festival and the attention it's getting from everybody around the world and in Ireland, that basically we don't have to ask people for walls anymore. We ask people submit them and artists submit to paint with us as well. So we just at first day was the first year was the hardest year. But once we told people what our plan was and why we were trying to do it, you'd be surprised at the amount of people that want to come on board to support an idea like that.
Now, Idel, we've been talking to lots of festival organisers and the, you know, how restricted COVID-19 has been on the organisation of festivals. How have you been affected by that?
Oh, it's been incredibly difficult. It's been an incredibly difficult space to navigate. But, you know, we are, I suppose, in one way it's advantageous for us because we're an outdoor festival. So we're able to, so we literally decided once COVID had broken out, we didn't know, you know, whether we'd be able to deliver the festival. But quickly kind of we decided to come up with a plan to see if there was any way that we could deliver it. And the only way that we could see that to deliver it safely for everybody was to cut all the social gathering parts of the festival, such as the festival hub, the expert panel talks, bus tours and so on, and just to leave it and keep the artwork. And now we're also kind of with the second, I think, phase opening of the country, we were able to start back our tours because our guided art tours are also outdoors. But it's been incredibly difficult. I mean, we've had to come up with all sorts of different plans. And
what about,
you know,
the international element? Has that been curbed because of the... So Joe Caslin, who is that very famed street artist, he has been a centrepiece of the festival in the past and is also so again this year. Can you tell us what he's doing for you this year?
Joe actually isn't painting with us this year, but Joe painted with us from the beginning of Waterford Walls. So he actually painted with us for 4 years. So 15, 16, 17 and 18. But his most famous piece, I suppose, for Waterford Walls in Waterford has been the Christ Redeemer figure, which is up in Jury's Hotel, the old Jury's Hotel overlooking the city. And that was done in 2016 and it's still there today.
OK, so who else have you so this year?
Well, besides Vanessa, who you're...
Yes, I'm going to talk to just in a second, of course. Yeah.
And we've had a collaboration with Irish artist duo Aches and Macer. We've had Garrett Joyce, Shane O'Driscoll, local artist Magdalena Carroll. And then with the cancellation of, postponement of the internationals to next year, because they're all dying to come and paint in Waterford, we've come up with a new programme where we've... confirmed five new Irish artists to paint in August. So they are Aches, Magda's painting a second wall, Quillan and Niall O'Loughlin are doing a collaboration, and the fifth artist is Decoy.
OK, we'll talk to Vanessa now, who's here opposite me. Vanessa, you're a sign painter, so that means that it's mainly words you put on the walls.
Yeah, all my work is word based. So I've been a sign painter now for about 5 or 6 years, painting mainly signs and murals around Dublin City.
Right. So tell me about your project in Waterford.
So this year is my third year painting at Waterford Walls, and I was given a wall to paint by Art Keen Quality Food Store. So
I see it here. It's kind of a gable wall, is it, or a side wall?
Yeah, it's a gable wall. So it was quite tall, about like 12 metres, I think. So I ended up painting it's kind of the tallest letters I've gotten to paint so far. So it was a good challenge. But I decided to paint something that being related to the shop almost. So I painted So Fresh and just painted a real bold kind of slab serif style of lettering and tried to have the have it look like it was expanding bigger than the wall
itself.
And
what colours do you use?
So it was a bright orange background and a purple shadow on the lettering and green front on the lettering. So it was really bright, yeah, and really brightened up that space because it was quite a grey wall when you walked it and you drove into the car park, so you can't miss it now. So
how many people would undertake that, the execution of that? I mean, is it just yourself?
Yeah, it was just myself. I had a cherry picker for 5 days working off that, so...
Yes, because you're like myself, you're fairly small, so I don't think you'd be able to reach very far up that wall.
Yeah, exactly. A ladder wouldn't have done it either. So there was one day I did get some help from one of the volunteers for a few hours, which was really great help. But generally, I would work by myself. But last year at Waterford Walls, the wall was 25 metres long. So that was quite a long wall. So there was myself and two other artists working on that one for last year's Waterford Walls.
So do people take the fresh as
fresh vegetables, or do they think it might be a place to get kind of fresh? They're all kind of possibilities.
Exactly. People can interpret whatever they, way they want. Yeah.
So tell us, you've done a lot of work in Dublin. Can you tell us of a few places that you would have done sign painting that we would know?
I've done a mural in Smithfield Meow Flower. I did that a couple of years ago. And I've done a mural as well in Temple Bar Lane, Come Here Shall I Tell You. That was commissioned by the Temple Bar Company.
Okay, and what was that about? What was it? Come Here Shall I Tell You?
They actually asked a lot of people to vote on their favourite Dublin saying. So that one came on top. And so I got to paint that in whatever style I liked. So
okay, what would that point to you in terms of colour and the type of lettering you would use?
Well, I always pick really bright colours for my projects. I love really bold colours. And I guess with lettering, I try and change the style or experiment with a different type style with each project. Or maybe if it's not a different type style, then maybe try and do something different with the shading or the styling or something, make it something different. So it's just because it keeps it more in string for myself, I guess.
And Adele, how does it break down the walls between lettering and, you know, and captions and then images?
That varies year on year. It depends. We look at each, like basically we're trying to build a collection here in Waterford and to make it one of the largest street art collections. So each year, depending on, we look at the collection at the end of each year, and we kind of like, say, for example, one year we had an awful lot of female portraits. So we decided that the next year we were going to have a bit more lettering in the artwork, as well as more kind of nature scenes or kind of, you know, or maybe creatures and animals rather than just female portraits. So it just varies year on year. It depends. We look at the collection at the end of each year and then we decide what we're going to focus on for the next year and what's going to suit the space. It also depends on the walls that come in. Like in the case of Vanessa's wall in Arkeen, we knew that Vanessa and lettering was really going to suit that space because, you know, we also work with the wall owners when we're going through about the artists that we're selecting for each wall. So it just depends on each year and, you know, because the collection is carefully curated year on year.
Yes, I see a picture of Vanessa here creating So Fresh, and her, you come up like about a third up the S in Fresh. So you're, yes, it's quite impressive, the size. Well, my thanks to Vanessa Power and Adele Tobin. Waterford Walls Festival continues until August the 28th. More information at waterfordwalls.ie, and you can see more of Vanessa's work at signofpower.com. Well, we hope you're blissed out after that piece of smooth hip hop, courtesy of Irish rapper Reggie Snow. And it also featured MF Doom and Cammy OB, and that was Kooky Chips. And we hope to talk to Reggie later in the year as new music emerges. Just coming up on 18 minutes to 8. 75 years ago, in the late spring of 1945, the city of Berlin collapsed under the onslaught from Russian armies invading from the east. The event brought an end to the most despotic and destructive regime in human history. However, many of the occupying German forces were quite vengeful in their treatment of the remaining population in Berlin. Among the Russian forces was a photographer called Valery Faminsky, and although his role was essentially to document the Russian triumph, Faminsky took the opportunity to photograph ordinary Germans whose world had collapsed around them. That portion of his photography remained hidden for decades after the war, and the images have only recently emerged and been published in a book called Berlin, May 1945, Valerie Faminski. Professor of History at Bard College, New York, Richard Aldous, has been looking at the book, and he joins me now from New York. Hello again, Richard.
Hello, Kate.
Just to give some context to the photographs, in the lead up to the taking of Berlin, there was a point, wasn't there, when the American forces were coming from the west, the Russians were coming from the east, and there was a bit of, was it argument or debate, or was it who would get to Berlin first?
Yeah, there's definitely a race which takes place in order to get to Berlin first. Stalin was determined that Soviet forces would get there before the Allied, the Anglo-American forces. He actually divided his two generals so that they would actually be in competition with each other, a battle that was eventually won by Marshal Zhukov, who was the first into Berlin. So, and the reason why they want to get there first, well, there are many reasons. One is the prestige, but also Stalin knew that the Germans had been working on nuclear research, and so he wanted to make sure that that he could get his hands on that material.
And what did the Americans feel about this? Were they on for the race, or were they a little more trepidatious, or they just thought, let the Russians have it?
This is actually one of the things that has changed, that historians have changed their mind about a little bit, actually, that the idea was always that, well, Eisenhower had been too slow off the mark, that perhaps he hadn't realized how important it would be for the Russians to get there first. I think historians writing more recently have said that Eisenhower actually knew what he was doing. This was all he saw the big picture. It had already been agreed that Berlin would be divided between the various allies and divided into zones. And so he was prepared to allow the Soviets to get there first. I think they would have got there first anyway, but certainly the way that Eisenhower saw it, this was not his main concern.
And now, it wasn't just the Russians would storm into Berlin. The Germans still had some fight left in them.
They did. And part of the reason for that, as you alluded to in your introduction, is that they really feared that the Soviet retribution would be extreme, that the behavior of the Germans when they had occupied the Soviet Union in those battles of Stalingrad and Leningrad, for example, a lot of the German behavior there had been beyond appalling, the worst kind of inhumanity. And so people genuinely feared that when the Soviets came to Berlin, that they would do the same thing. And actually, they were right to have that fear. I mean, we find it difficult, actually, now even to talk about the kind of inhumanity that was on display. To kind of be very explicit about it, the estimate is that around 2 million German women were raped during the battle for Germany. Over 100,000 are estimated to have been raped during the battle for Berlin. So this is the kind of worst kind of degradation and appalling behaviour by soldiers that you can possibly imagine.
And obviously, Faminski was one of the troops, the Russian troops, but there is no echo or mention of those awful atrocities against German women in these photographs.
Yeah, it's actually one of the, I think that a lot of this book, seeing the photojournalism of Valerie Faminski, you sense that he is just snapping ordinary people as they're kind of going about living their everyday lives under occupation. But as you say, this kind of darker side is definitely missing from the book, that there is almost, the phrase that came to mind actually is that famous one of Hannah Arendt, who talks about the banality of evil. That you kind of see kind of people just going around, Soviet soldiers, just doing their kind of reading magazines, sitting smoking, and I'm sure that for many of them, that's all they had done. But nevertheless, we still have to confront this really, truly dreadful act that many of them had committed, some of these dreadful crimes, particularly against women, and that not only were many women raped, they were also then subsequently murdered. So there is a kind of a level of evil that is committed during this occupation that is almost entirely absent from this book.
Of course, the Führer is dead at this stage. He committed suicide when the Russians were on the cusp of taking Berlin.
That's right. Although actually, Valery Faminski, it looks from the photographs as if he arrives just in the days before Hitler actually commits suicide. So he's in the kind of the suburbs of Berlin at exactly this moment. It's one of the things that actually is remarkable about Faminski that, I mean, he had been given a medical exemption from serving, but he still volunteered to kind of accompany the Red Army. He was on seven fronts. He was in Crimea. He was in the battle for Bucharest in Romania, in the battle for Poland, and then the battle for Germany as well. So he is there on the front line documenting one of the most ferocious battles in the entire war, that there were around 2.5 million Red Army troops involved in this, 6,000 tanks, a million artillery shells were used in the kind of bombardment of Berlin. And that actually is something that really does come across from these photographs, the sheer physical destruction, first from the Allied bombing campaign and then from the subsequent artillery shelling as the Soviets moved into Berlin.
Now, the moving in of the Soviets into Berlin is quite extraordinary. I mean, there's one picture of a Russian who has a strange chariot in which he's carrying one of his injured fellow soldiers. Can you describe that one, the one with the dogs?
Yeah, it's interesting, actually. The first thing that we should say here is that Faminski's specific task was to do the kind of thing that you're describing there, that he was actually attached to the military museum in Moscow. So his job was to take photographs of the wounded, of the hospitals. And as you say, in kind of photographs like the one that you've described there, the kind of the ability to be imaginative, to kind of battle situations, to have to do things that are unconventional. There are many other photographs taken in the hospital of people as they undergo operations, and very moving photographs of various tank regiments giving a kind of a last salute to their kind of fallen comrades, including one unit where there is just one soldier who has survived the battle.
And there's one photograph again of a tank crew, and it looks as though their commander has his head covered in very loose bandages. He's like a mummy who's demummying himself as the bandages come off, and then he has this, you know, torn and ragged group of soldiers opposite him.
Yeah, in fact, I think that is one of the things that comes across very well. In some ways, the photographs of the Soviet soldiers are almost more revealing than the ones of the German civilians, that you do get this kind of sense of the reality of war, that the immediacy of the battle still feels very fresh. The kind of the sense of victory is very clear there, but also of the human cost in this for the Soviet soldiers. After all, 70,000, an estimated 70,000 Soviet Red Army troops died in this battle. A lot of that was because of the incompetence of the strategy, that getting to Berlin was really all that mattered. So very often the Red Army troops were killed or bombed by other Red Army troops, but all that mattered was getting there. And as you say, kind of photographs like that strip away any sense of the kind of the glory or glamour of war. This is the kind of the reality of war, red in tooth and claw.
Now, the rubble of the city is plain to see in these photographs. But the German people themselves, notwithstanding, I know the awful things they are about to go through, and there are many pictures of women, but I think you thought that they look a little better than the inhabitants of London did around the same time.
Yeah, it is one of the elements that I found quite surprising about this. And in some ways, it's a good example that sometimes the camera can lie, that, in other words, this is a selection of photographs and so doesn't capture, obviously, the kind of the full experience. But, you know, the impression, if you read, for example, Anthony Beaver's wonderful book on the fall of Berlin, he talks about the deprivations in Berlin, that this is a city which is essentially starving. And the photographs that Fominski has taken don't really seem to kind of back that up, that people look as if they're just going around about in their ordinary lives. They look reasonably well fed. They look reasonably well clothed. For example, all the children are wearing shoes. If you look at comparable photographs of London during the Blitz and so on, very often the children will look really quite decimated, but also their clothes will be ragged, they won't be wearing shoes and so on. So, you know, I wouldn't want to read too much into this, because as I say, it's a selection of photographs, but it was something that kind of changed, or perhaps not changed what I thought, but modified my sense of what Berlin was like in the spring of 1945.
As you say, Fominski seemed to have, you know, pretty much access all areas, being with the winning troops. But there's no created images, you know, the glorious march on Berlin by the Russian forces. They're quite like, even the reading of the surrender of the streets of Berlin in May 8th is a very ordinary photograph. It could be just an ordinary announcement rather than this really important event.
Yeah, that's very striking, isn't it? That series of photographs. There's a lot of interest. There's a photograph of people clamoring to get hold of the declaration of Germany, of the surrender and the war coming to an end. But there are other photographs of these kind of speeches being made and a kind of sense of pomp and ceremony. And there are just ordinary Germans, particularly children, just kind of wandering along, kind of ignoring kind of what's going on. They've got more important things. Seems to be kind of thinking about. It is true that he does have a kind of incredible access, and there is a kind of a coolness which I admire about the photographs. As you say, there may be a sin of omission with some of the things, the kind of horrific incidents we talked about before, but he doesn't seem to be creating photographs. He's just snapping what he sees with his Leica camera. I did notice in the little piece that had been written by him that he mentioned that he'd been in the NKVD, which was the Soviet secret police, this can only be a guess, but I did wonder whether that previous connection had somehow a kind of played out into this situation that he was in now, because he does, as you rightly say, seem to have remarkable freedom to wander, to photograph pretty much whatever he wants. And so there's a kind of a curiosity about that kind of intrigues, I think.
Well, Richard Aldous, thank you so much. The book is called Berlin 1945 by Valerie Fominski, and it's published by Buchskunst Berlin.
Love can last forever between you and me. You are my mountain, you are my sea. I am a mountain.
That was Biffy Clyro, and the fans will recognise that that's their 2009 single Mountains. They have released their 9th studio album, and that's out this Friday, one of 3 we will be reviewing on Arena, along with Chris Wasser talking about Christopher Nolan it's not out yet. We're hoping to get Tenet's, Christopher Nolan's new film, in the next few months, but God only knows. That's it for tonight's Arena. Research was by Liam Murphy and Paula Shields. Kieran Cullum was on sound. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Olam McGowan.